70 in 7. A win today, hockey o'clock. Original.
Win today, hockey o'clock.
In diesem Augenblick wird's jetzt richtig hitzig. Yeah, und die Scheibe kollert über die Linie.
Nee. Mittendrin statt nur dabei.
Das ist unglaublich, was die hier zelebrieren.
Nice move, another nice move.
Unbelievably so. It's already part number 5 of 70 in 7. The great Hockey O'Clock original series that dissects and depicts the hockey life of the great Greg Holst, player legend, coaching legend. I think a couple weeks ago I termed you overall legend. First of all, Coach Greg Holst, always a pleasure talking hockey with you, talking about the fifth decade of your being. We're talking about the years 1994 to 2004. Great to have you on the line. Great to have you here on Win Today Hockey O'Clock.
Oh, Martin, nice to talk to you. And here we go again. And I can honestly tell you, and I know my friends get a kick out of it too, when we hear the word legend, we kind of laugh because, you know, we're just freaking hockey kids from Canada, Montreal. And when you hear that word, you sound old. Well, that I am. So thank you for the compliment. And here we go with the next part of my life.
See, the interesting thing about legend, and I tend to think it gets overused, especially when looking back at maybe last 10 to 15 years, it's always about scope. But if you're asking anyone in Austria, maybe even European hockey, and you tell them the name Greg Holst, for 90%, 95%, there'd be a bell that rings. Yeah, Greg Holst, I know him. I heard of him. And there's so many people who are labeled legends now where basically no one would know their feats and what they've done. So in the truest sense of the words, you really deserve that moniker. And I know it changes for a lot of people. And again, as legend is so easily assigned to things and people or legendary moments and whatnot nowadays. But this is truly something that you deserve so much because of everything that you did. And holy shit, like the feedback I've received so far and all the people that have been listening to this and all the people that have enjoyed this so far, this has really been a great ride. So I'm really looking forward to talking to you about I'd label it twilight, maybe years of your career, right in between of finishing your playing days and going on to an adventure and starting your coaching career. So this is great. And also the fact that we've got two more weeks to go and two episodes that I consider being juicy and full of stuff that people will enjoy. But this time around, today, we're going to talk about you from the years 1994 to 2004. This being part 5, this being only 3 weeks away from your 70th anniversary. And just to get this out of the way, how does it make you feel to just being away 3 weeks from your 70th anniversary?
Well, first of all, thank you for the compliment on that legend stuff. Second of all, it's my birthday, not my anniversary, because I was never married 75 years like my mom and dad, because they have their 75th coming, which is freaking unbelievable. So it's still a little bit, actually talked to my boys in the last couple of days about it. It's not like 60. Because when you're 60, I was still rocking and coaching, and 10 years later, you're 70. Now I go, shit, in 10 years, I'll be freaking 80. So it's got a different vibe to it. But you know what? I feel young. I got lots of energy. So it is what it is. And I'm kind of, to be honest, to tell you the truth, when I was young and some of my crazy days, I never knew if I was going to get to 70. So far, so good. Touch wood.
See, that tends to happen to the stupid Austrian who didn't grow up having English as his first language. Birthday versus anniversary. There is a difference. It's your 70th birthday that everybody's looking forward to celebrating. That's going to happen in 3 weeks' time. In the meantime, we'll talk about the transition from you and your playing career to you eventually becoming a coach. And we finished last week in the last episode with an emotional statement from your son and family stuff. But you knew and you told me that your career had come to an end. The grad season kind of made certain of you, or made certain that that this would be the last kind of days and months seeing you perform for the Austrian fans that have grown to like you or hate you, whatever way. And you said you were happy to get out of the game relatively healthy. We'll get to you trying to return to play in the game, but after calling it a career, what was the general sentiment of what you would be doing with the rest of your life?
Well, as you know, in that December, we went to Sanibel Island, Florida for 6 months, where we had been going every year. So we spent 6 months there into July. And it's interesting because Mike went to school there, Taylor went to kindergarten. Because it wasn't a 3 to 4 month stint where we went the last 5 or 6 years, where I trained to go back to play, going there for 6 months with the possibility of living there was not as enjoyable as what we had done before. So we still had a good time, but this was okay. What are we going to do when the kids are done school? Where are we going to live? It was not going to be Montreal. It was going to be Western Canada somewhere. We didn't know where. Vancouver became too expensive. We explored that. We ended up in Kelowna by accident, which I had never heard about Kelowna. That's where we ended up. I can tell you quickly how that transpired, if you like.
Shoot. I mean, that's a thing. How you end up in a place that you never heard of. You grew up in Eastern Canada, in Montreal. You could have just as well ended up in Winnipeg, always, even though no one apparently likes to be in Winnipeg outside of people who grew up in Winnipeg. But as Vancouver wasn't really an option, why Kelowna?
So, well, Satch and Shelley were living in Vancouver. I think Port Coquitlam. And mom and dad actually came out, their big truck. They were looking around out west too, maybe to move out west, a change of life. And Satch was doing a hockey program, and he was having a hockey school at Logan Lake, which is up around the Merritt area. It's about 4 hours, 3.5 hours from Vancouver. So I'm working the hockey school. Christine and the kids were there. Mom and dad went over the connector and found a city called Peachland, which I had never heard. Well, I said, it's got to be a lot of peaches, I guess. So they came back and said, hey, you got to see this place. So myself, Christine at the time, we drove with my parents over the connector and we pull into see this Okanagan Lake. So Peachland is just south of Kelowna. And we went, wow. We had already explored Vancouver, North Vancouver, but it was very expensive. So what's the next option? We found this, we looked, and we said, what do you think? That's how we got to Kelowna. We rented in our first year and we were on the lookout, see how we like it. And eventually we did buy a house, but that's a story that will come up in a bit. And that's how we ended up in Kelowna.
Just to get us out of our way, are there peaches in Peachland?
Yes, there is. And you know who moved to Peachland and lived there for about 15 years? My parents. So they did buy a place right up above the water. And we were down the road, you know, 15, 20 minutes, still on the west side, which is West Kelowna, on this side of the bridge. We were on Parkinson Avenue. I remember the house. We rented it. We had a great time. The kids had a great time, a great school. Actually, a beautiful area to live in. It was a great start to being back in Canada. But there was only one problem. What am I going to do? I played hockey my whole life, and I'm almost 40 years old.
We'll get to that in a bit. And if people listen to this program and have never been to Canada and maybe the Kelowna area on the Okanagan Lake, Kelowna, a junior hockey hotbed. Like if you look at the Kelowna Rockets alumni over the last couple of decades, it's incredible what kind of output this program still has. It's located, situated at a great lake. Landscape seems to be perfect, so a really nice place to settle in, maybe not settle down, but as your playing career had come to an end at that time, and all the people who retire from pro sports always keep referring to, I'm missing the boys, I'm missing the locker room, I'm missing the bus rides, I'm missing the many little instances of being a pro hockey player. What did you miss? Did you miss anything after having moved back to Canada from your playing days?
Well, let me just say this. I knew a couple guys, George, Masut, maybe one other guy, and they were playing with all the pro guys and some of the normal guys once or twice a week, like a Tuesday night, say at 8:30. They'd play an hour and a half, have all the beers after. That was the dressing room. So I got hooked up in this pretty quick. So that was a little bit of a savior for me. But no, I wasn't. What do you miss? I actually missed the dressing room and the practices, which sounds funny, but I didn't miss the games. A lot of guys miss the games and not the practices. I missed the dressing room and the games. But I got to tell you a quick story. So I'm 40 years old, almost 40, and I'm starting to play with these old-timer guys, ex-NHL players, ex-junior players, and a bunch of normal guys. It's a good group. So I get out there, one of my first nights, and I'd still play, obviously, and I'm scoring some goals, deking and diving. Not much was said. I talked to a couple of my buddies, but we go in the dressing room. We have a big tub of beer. So you take three beers for $5. So I took my three cans, I line them up, and I shower quick. Some guys sit there in their gear. Some guys take their time. I like to get changed, cowboy boots on, my jeans jacket on, my jeans. That's when I start to drink my beer. So I'm ready to go. I crack open the can, my first can of beer. Guys are looking at me, but not really. I have in my jean jacket a salt shaker. So now I take out the salt shaker and I sprinkle a little bit in my beer. Now the guys are looking over a little bit and going, a little bit of a buzz, like, what's he doing? Okay, that's not the best part. So I have a couple slugs. And then in my other pocket, I had the little blue container, Prise, the snuff tobacco, the snuff. I take it out. I put a little of that brown stuff on my hand, and I snort it up. And it's like menthol. I went, whoa, now it is, what is going on? Who the hell are you? What the hell are you doing? and let's pass that stuff around. And it became, I had to order freaking stuff from Austria. This became so funny. True story. What a start. But if you could back it up and play, that's what we talked about. I still was flying. Now you got salt and this tobacco. The guys just had a great time with that story.
Jesus, snuff, tobacco, whatever it is labeled. My grandfather used to do that a lot, and it seems so, so far away because you hardly ever see people doing that nowadays. But help me bridge the gap a little bit from you finishing your career or your pro hockey playing days and you knowing, okay, there has to be some kind of income to pay the bills, and you starting giving private hockey lessons. How did that all come about?
Okay, so I checked where I knew a couple of kids through a couple of connections. I think it might have been Kim Gellard and my guys were too young that maybe, Mike was probably too young. So I'm trying to remember exactly. So I rented ice. I found some in Rutland, which is, there's two rinks, but I rented from 6 to 8. And I would do like an hour, 2 hours of just skill with kids. And I started with 5 or 6 kids. And, it went really well because I could teach skill and skating and stuff, but more the stick handling and all that kind of stuff. And I did that a couple of weeks. Then I had about 8 kids. And then I had 10 kids. And before you know it, after a couple of months, I had 20 kids. So word got around quick that I was doing something interesting with the kids. And everybody loves hockey. They're looking for a new voice, something new. And that's how I started. So at the start, I was losing money paying for the ice. But eventually, I started making a few bucks. Nothing major. Not a whole lot to live on. But I started something. But you know what's funny, Martin? I was doing this, and I was done at 8 o'clock. So if I had somebody on helping me, which sometimes I did, sometimes not, I slipped down to McDonald's or Tim Hortons and have a coffee at 8:30 in the morning. So my work day's over. So what am I going to do now all day? So I would go back over to the west side where we were living. The kids were in school. We did stuff. We worked out, all that. So it took me a while to build this up, but there was a lot of free time. And I had a couple of sessions at night skating with the guys. That kind of kept me going a little bit. I got into golf, was playing golf over on the west side. So that was a transition, 8:30 in the morning, only on a Monday. This wasn't every day. This was like, I'm trying to think, was it every day? I can't even remember. It was 1 or 2 days a week that I did this. So I had a lot of free time, but that's how I started to get a connection to the kids, which the next year led into something else, which we will talk about.
I don't know if that's what we're going to talk about right away, but just to back this up, with former players, you're always talking about the itch of playing, the itch of being on the ice, the itch of having a competitive hockey game. You turned your back to pro hockey, but did that itch ever go away? I'm asking because 1.5 years after your retirement, you eventually turned up to play hockey again in Austria, in Wattens, which is kind of curious. And I asked you before about helping me bridge the gap. How did it come that you returned to play hockey in Tyrol, where you became the Greg Holst, and playing hockey in Wattens, not pro hockey anymore, or at the very least not from the outset looking in? How did that develop, that you were kind of trying to return onto the ice?
I think if I remember correctly, that was 94-95, that season, that Christmas. I believe we went over for the Christmas break and stayed for a month or 6 weeks. It was something like that. So Vatins is playing in the third league. And I do have a story on that because you know my history with Innsbruck and some of the players and some of the management, whether it's jealousy, the Tiroler Night, or whatever you want to call it. You know, and they didn't treat Mike, my son, very well. Taylor just never wanted to be a part of that ever again. So I'm not going to get into that too much, but I'll just tell you something. So I played maybe four or five games in the third league, and it wasn't that freaking simple. But we're playing at home against Silts. Silts has all the Innsbruck players, all from the first league, all those guys, the guys that I really think don't love me. So they are the first place team. They're heavily favorite. We had over 1,000 fans jammed into that Vatins rink. So you think I was a little bit motivated at age 41 or 40 or 41?
I don't think so.
Well, I was. So
really? Okay. That's a surprise.
We upset this team 7-6. And I got 6 goals. And it was fabulous. They did not like it, but that's the way it goes. So I still had it. Well, I remember that so clearly. Just because.
I mean, did you ever get any offers upon that? You were still in your early 40s. If you look at the likes of Chris Chelios and Dominik Hasek and Jagomir Jagr, who all played or are still playing into the late 40s and early 50s, did you ever think about, you know what, maybe there is still a full-time return onto the ice in me?
When we talked about in the last podcast we had, Martin, when I stopped playing in Graz, for me to want to play longer into maybe 40, maybe 41, you got to have the right coach. It's 100% important. The guys are important, obviously. We had a good bunch of guys. You have to have the right coach who knows how to handle the ice time, the situations, keeping it fun, keeping it exciting. That was not the case. And that's one of the big reasons that I stopped.
What was still trying on this part of 17-7, the great hockey life of Greg Holst that we're trying to dissect over, or that we've already dissected over the past couple of weeks and that we're trying to dissect over the next couple of weeks, is how you eventually got into coaching. You had that private lessons gig. You had kids that turned up, and even more kids that started to turn up for what you did. But at what point did you think, okay, coaching could indeed be my career after my career?
Well, I also work with Satch a little bit with his hockey store scuff, and I think I coached a couple of traveling teams a little bit. But what happened, word got around because of my morning stuff, and I knew now Ellie Vortichuk, I knew George, I knew a couple guys. Word got around a little bit about maybe they were going to ask me to coach in 1995 one of the Bantam teams. So they called me in and they said, Greg, would you be interested in coaching the Bantam team, the AAA team? And I said, well, yeah, you know, what is it? What are the details? What's the situation? They said, well, I said, I'll think about it. So I thought about it. I went back and I said, look, yeah, I would like to coach. But there was a top AAA team, and then there was a second AAA team. And the coach of the top AAA team the year before was had some trouble with how he treated the players. It wasn't very good. So he was more than likely going to be gone. I said, well, is it the top team or is it the second team? Well, we have decided to give last year's coach another opportunity. I said, okay, whatever. But would you be interested in taking the second team? I said, possibly. But we would like you to go into the B League, not in the AAA League. And I said, if I'm going to coach that team, I am not going to the B League. I stay in the AAA League. And that's where if I take this job, we have to be in the AAA. I'm not interested in winning the B. I'm interested in these kids getting developed, and it'll be freaking tough. They didn't like that. I said, okay, well, you guys think about it. They talked about it, got back to me, and they said, yes. That's how I started coaching my first real team.
You know, as we have so many international listeners, especially from Canada, which is kind of astounding. And then again, it's really not, because you've left your imprints and footsteps, footmarks, whatever, on so many different parts of Canada too. Just try to bring up people from maybe Europe and especially Austria up to speed. What's Bantam? What's AAA? What are all these kind of leagues, and where did you want to try to end up coaching?
Well, Bantam is 15-year-olds, right? 15, 16. It's like Schuler. It's called Schuler here. Here will be called U16. So most of these guys were 15 years old. So the Bantam AAA, that means Kamloops was the top team. That is the top Bantam team of all the teams. Then you go AA. So they wanted me to go to AA, right? Which was kind of like B, which is the teams are not as strong. They'd be smaller communities. Then you have Bantam A, which is even lower. Then you have House League, which is the lowest league where kids just want to play, have some fun. So Martin, I talked to the parents. I had Brad Campo, a good buddy of mine. Actually, we talked a couple of days ago because a good friend of ours did pass away. Glenn Cochran, very, very sad. And Paul Mitchell, whose son was the goalie, he's a top lawyer in Kelowna. He became my manager. We had a great time. And Brad, we became buddies. He was my assistant coach. And I think Bobby Moon, another guy, helped out. But Brad was one of my key assistants and goalie coach, Paul Mitchell. So we had a meeting with the parents. And I said, listen, leave the players to us. Nobody's going to come in yelling at me, screaming, look, if you have a question, give it 24 hours, come see. I want you guys to travel with us, have your wines and your beers, have some fun. But I'm going to tell you, this is going to be tough. We're in a tough league, and we're going to have to work. My team was the Bad News Bears. This is freaking unbelievable. And I had a great bunch of guys, and to this day, I know a bunch of them. So anyway, I'll just move ahead quickly. The parents said, okay, great. We're going to let you run with this. Game one in Kamloops against the top team. Final score, 16-0. We lost. But here's what's interesting. After the first period, it was 1-0. They had a young coach, pretty cocky, as I found out after the second. We come off the ice. At the end of the second, we're down 8-0. So now their players were all standing on the boards on the ice because we have to go off first. They turn their sticks upside down, being cocky. They're going to play with their sticks upside down now. Okay, so we get into the dressing room. And a couple of those kids made a couple of comments, whatever. So my guys, my Bad News Bears are sitting there, white as ghosts, half of them. And their room was only a few meters from ours. And their young coach come walking down the thing. And I said something to him. I said, hey, you know what your guys are saying? They turned their sticks upside down and they're making a few comments. You know, my guys are trying. He tied into me. He said, we could have blown you out in the first freaking period. I said, really? I said, I had some choice words. We were nose to nose and it was loud. And it was loud, nose to nose, and we were going at it, not physically, just verbally. And I knew my players heard this because I wanted them to hear it. I walked in the room. It was so quiet. These guys were freaking. I said, guys, it doesn't matter. Hey, so they saw I'm sticking up for these guys. We went out. We lost 16-0. Parents came out. Boom. Hey, guys, it's all part of the process. So let me run something happened here quick. About a month later, Eric Lindros, this is a very sad story. Eric Lindros's nephew, I believe it was his nephew. His name was, he was 15. I think he had a heart attack and something happened. He died. So the next time we had a card sent up to those guys right away, you know, because this is a tragic story. I don't care about face-to-face with the coach. This is a tragic story. But we, right away, we showed respect. We sent a card. And you know what, Martin? My guys worked their butt off. And a month and a half or 2 months later, we played them in Kelowna. And we lost 5-3. And their coach came up to me and said, you know, thank you very much for the, you know, it almost puts a tear in my eye now, but with Lindros and you guys are coming a long way and good job. So credit to my kids for working the rear ends off. Few of those guys, Kenny McGowan, he was one of the top players in Germany for a couple of years. And he was going to sign at Villach the year I stopped coaching at Villach. Kenny McGowan, Stoxy, Sukball, the big Indian fella, he still has a big farm in his family. Greg, come up anytime, pick grapes. I still have contact with some of these guys. So that was my first coaching experience. So I'll just finish off the season. Here I am coaching. We move up from kind of last place to about fifth place. So that's a good step. And we went into the tournaments, into the double A tournaments, where we kind of belong. But because we played triple A, we got better. And we won the double A tournaments. So this was the development part I was talking about. We wouldn't have won those tournaments without playing in the top league. So we come down to the end of the year, the last meeting. Brad's in there. Christine's in there. Paul Mitchell. All the parents were having like a final dinner. You put so much emotion into this and these kids and the fun we had and the practice and the tough. And I headbutted everything. I stood up to say my final speech. I couldn't talk. I had to stop. I had freaking tears in my eyes. I couldn't talk. I had to leave the restaurant because these are like my kids. So I collected myself. Brad came out, got me back in. I had a nice talk with everybody, thanked everybody. That's how much emotion and connection I had with these kids. Brad did a great job. Paul Mitchell did a great job. The parents. What a year. A year none of us will ever forget. So 15 years later, I'm standing in the bar down on the, standing down at the bar on the at the El Dorado on the water in Kelowna. And it was probably 15 years after. And there's a young guy beside me. And I'm having a beer. And he orders a beer. And he looks over. He said, hey, coach, you don't remember me, right? I said, sure I do. Eichel, number 9, right-handed shot. Holy shit, he said. You don't forget your guys. So in the summer, I had a traveling team now because I've got some traveling teams. I get all the best players together and we go to tournaments. Do you know, Martin, I'm just saying, they had a meeting. They have coaches of the year in all the categories. I wasn't at these meetings because I was coaching on the road. Finishing in fifth place, I got coach of the year in the Bantam in Kelowna. So what does it tell you about having to be in first or second place or winning everything. I was kind of shocked, but it reaffirmed trying to develop the kids, having a tight family, the parents. We had a fantastic time. That's where my coaching really began.
That'd have been a natural follow-up question, and it actually is. Where along this ride did you realize, hey, coaching is something that's in me? Coaching is something that I want to keep doing for the foreseeable future.
I really honestly don't think I did. I think, let's see what happens. Well, I probably thought about it. Do I coach another year at Bantam? Okay, now we're getting into the 96-97 season, right? Okay, am I going to coach Bantam again? What am I thinking? Somehow a connection came up. I don't know how. I can't remember. Greg, would you be interested in having a meeting with Kimberley? Beautiful city up in the mountains. Kimberley, British Columbia. You can Google it. It's fantastic. They're in the junior league, not the top league, the next league, right? And I go, yeah. So Christine and I, we went up there. I'm not sure. I asked Mike yesterday, did you come up with us? He can't remember. I met with the Kimberley team because they had my resume playing all these years. Okay, I coached Bantam, doing private stuff. Okay. But the resume is a big one because I know how to play and whatever. I met a couple guys. So we had a meeting next day. There was a whole board. The whole table was there. They offered me the coaching job, the GM's job, set up. The salary wasn't great, but it was okay. All kinds of bonuses to make more money, to make it really appealing to me. Okay. So I said, let me think about this. I need a couple of days off. I do my best to remember how it went. Then I got in contact. I talked to Christine about the kids maybe going back to Vatins because of the schooling. Because the schooling is very, very good in Austria. Vatins, we did talk to Vatins. What do you think? You can bring me in. Hartrack is okay. What do you think? So we talked about this as a family. We decided to go to Vatins. They were in the second league now. Lustenau came down for the first league. We're a little bit over our head. We chose to go to Vatins to leave Kimberley behind. Who knows what would have happened in my coaching career if I would have coached there, where it would have taken me. We don't know. Went back to Vatins, coached in that second league. It was tough. That's why we went back, because of the schooling for the kids.
I don't know if this is the halfway point of the episode, but we at the very least started talking about you getting into the coaching business. And oh boy, what a ride it became. We'll talk about so much more. We talk about everything else that happened in between 1994 and 2004 after a very quick break here on part 5 of 70 in 7.
Win today, hockey, go far. Do you enjoy listening to Win Today, Hockey O'Clock? If that is the case, then please rate the podcast. A 5-star rating or a review over at the podcast dealer of your choice would go a long way in helping to spread the good word of hockey. Win Today, Hockey O'Clock, the hockey podcast with real and open-ended hockey conversations. Win Today, Hockey O'Clock.
Back on 70 in 7, back on everything that is the hockey life of Greg Holst with his 70th birthday incoming. On part 5, we're talking about the years 1994 to 2004 of his great hockey life. Coach, so glad to still have you on Win Today Hockey O'Clock right here. And before the break, we talked about you kind of wrapping your head around a coaching career. Now that it became a reality, and now that you had moved back to Vatins and still coach, how was it to coach adult players, how was it to we spoke before the recording, so you told me that it was interesting seeing them play, and you also wanted to play, so you became kind of a player's coach. How was all that? We're talking about the year 1996-97.
Well, we were short benched a few games, so I played a few games, but I remember playing one game in Innsbruck, and they had a few German guys, and I got hocked two or three times. And I remember I turned around and just freaking two-handed these guys, and the refs were great because they saw me kind of get hocked, and I hocked back, and they came up to me. They actually were good. They said, "Greg, okay, settle down, whatever." But I remember after that game in Innsbruck, I said, "Nah, I don't need this anymore." A few comments came out of the Innsbruck side. Oh, how slow I've gotten. Well, guys, I'm 42 freaking years old, but I don't care what the Innsbruck guy said. But I knew then, okay, and that was my last game. I didn't play again. But coaching the man, like we had three imports. Ole Hicks, who's still over there. He's working now in Stutzing. He coached in Vatens. He ran the St. Polten Academy for years. That's how his career started. So we had three guys, and you know, two Canadians. And do you know what those three guys made for contracts in the second league for the season? 60,000 shillings. And they had
that's not a lot.
No. They had an apartment. They got flown over. I think they split a car, helped with the kids, made a few extra bucks here and there. But that's how you got to sometimes start your career. It was a real good experience. I remember we played against Lustenau. I think Ray Podlovsky was even playing. They had good. They're coming out of the first league. We hung in there pretty good. So our guys, and we had maybe eight guys or nine guys from Vatens playing in the second league. We worked our freaking butts off. It was quite an experience. And that's where it kind of began, right? But after that season, I knew I wasn't going to come back to Vatens. I didn't know what I was going to do. So until I got a phone call.
We have to talk about that phone call because we all know where it led to. Obviously, you being involved with the Austrian Federation and the national teams, and that'll be your career for the next couple of years. But yeah, let's talk about the phone call.
Well, so, you know, I believe we went back to Canada in the summer, but we did buy a home in Kelowna up in Crawford Estates, a beautiful home. And we had land in the back, so the kids had a great time growing up there for the years we were there. They built a little tree for it. We had a nice pool. Christine, we had a fantastic time in Kelowna. But now we're into 97, and I think we bought in 1995. So anyway, we go back to the home, having a great time, and I get a phone call. The national team, if I remember correctly, was playing in Poland. And Ron Kennedy and Joe Meehan phoned me. They knew I had worked with the Bantam team. They knew I was doing hockey schools, which I had started, which we haven't mentioned yet, down in Summerland, which I also got going after the Bantam year, because now my name was good. So me starting that hockey school, I had freaking 4 weeks of kids. That was what the Bantam year created. It created interest for me to come to the hockey school. Okay, I just backtracking. So I get the phone call. So they know I've coached Bantam. I coach in the second league, so I'm coaching kids. Would you be interested in working with the U18, U20, and be an assistant with Ron? I think Joe asked me, and Ron was on the conversation. Head coach, U18. Head coach, U20. Assistant coach with the national team. I said, well, sounds quite interesting. You know, how's the pay structure? There was not a lot of money in this, but it was spread out over 12 months. And it was an opportunity that also brought us back to Austria where the kids' schooling could continue, right? And of course, Christine's from there, so family and friends. I took it on. And that's how I got into the national team program, Joe Meehan and Ron Kennedy. And of course, Ron Kennedy backed me 100% because he knows me and we played two years together in Innsbruck. So he knew I could play. He knew I could coach kids. He knew I coached Bantam. I might be a little bit of the Canadian, even though I had Austrian passport too. You got the Canadian mentality, the Canadian passion and drive. And that's when the fun began.
But looking back on this, and we're talking about this more than a quarter century after it happened, and I'm just wondering about the kind of coach that you had become by then, and now with having coached so many years and decades of your life, how you look back on the kind of coach that you were then, the kind of coach you were aspiring to be. How did you want to be as a coach back then, and how do you look back on it right now?
Well, you know, I was really shooting from the hip a lot. I did take my coaching courses in Canada, which you have to have to coach. You know, I got up to intermediate two or advanced two, whatever it was, which you needed to coach the Bantams and whatever. Number one, I thought about all the coaches I had in my career. Who were my favorite coaches? Forby Kennedy, certain coaches, right? I want to be a player's coach. I played the game. I know how the guys feel. We're going to practice tough. I'm going to be fair. We're going to change a few. We changed a few things right off the bat, but I was shooting from the hip a lot. So if I ran my first year coaching the Bantam in 95, if I ran that practice now, the practice would be totally different. Totally different. Just the speed, the skill, the different things that I've developed, how you think, how the drills have developed. Of course, you learn. But for me, number one is you got to be a player's coach. So they can connect with me. My door's always open. You have fun. It's humor. All the stuff we talked about, Martin, even when we're doing TV, it's tough calls. It's having fun, having humor. It's all the same. It's what kind of team do you have in the TV? What kind of team do you have in every job in the bank? It's all about teams. So we got a hockey team now. You have to treat all the guys equally. Do you know what the first thing I changed with the U18 national team? Because the first time I went to a tournament with these guys, I was shocked. I had good players. How they turned up their dress code. We had guys come with sandals and jean shorts. Like I'm going, we're playing like an international tournament, like a floor tournament, Slovenia, Hungary, whatever. The guys came in jeans, cut off jeans. Through this tournament, guys, we're going to have some new rules. So we got through that one and we sat down and we set up some rules. Our dress code changed. We are now coming, especially, we had to be respectable for the tournaments that were those three or four tournaments we had, but we're going to the World Championships. I don't care if it's CBA pool. We're wearing suits, shirts, and ties. We're going to look freaking professional. And you know what? The guys freaking loved it. They felt good. They felt classy. They felt like NHL players. They absolutely bought into it and they loved it. And we sat and had meetings, all the stuff. Okay, write everything down, guys, on the board. What is in our control? What's not in our control? Okay, the weather, the ice, the refs. What can we control? How do we want to play? What about body language? We had these kind of meetings. I was just learning as we went along. But the guys bought in. We had a lot of really good players through the 7 years I did this, Martin. So many great players came through the program. And I just helped them. I had some good assistant coaches. And what a time. But what a learning experience. And then, of course, I go to the A National Pool with Ron Kennedy and Joe and Dieter Carlton, everybody, and Dr. Bachler. Man, I just coached freaking in the second league in that. Now I'm coaching, assistant coach in the A pool in the World Championships. It goes fast. But the stepping stone was U18, U20, national team. It just all worked. And we know how good Ron was.
And you know, one of the players on those junior national teams, one of your longest standing friendships as of right now is with Marcus Pintner. He used to be a player on one of those teams, and he, of course, is looking back on those times too, and he brought along a great story, a great couple of stories. I'd like you to listen in with me to this, and for all the international listeners and non-German speakers, this will be kind of translated so that you get the gist of it afterwards. But this is Marcus Pintner, former Austrian national team player, former player under Greg Holst when he coached the junior national teams. And he puts on some perspective on all the things that happened and the kind of coach you were. We're going to listen into it and then we're going to talk about it.
Hallo Martin. Über Holst gibt es natürlich sehr viele Geschichten, sehr viele schöne Geschichten und schöne Erfahrungen von meiner Seite. Ich durfte ihn schon relativ früh kennenlernen. In meinem zweiten Jahr in der U18 habe ich das Glück gehabt, dass er mich schon für die U20, für die Nationalmannschaft nominiert hat. Und man hat da gleich gemerkt, in meinem zweiten Jahr im U20-Team, dass unterm Holst ein ganz anderer Wind weht. Ihm waren die Werte in der Kabine, beim Essen, beim gemeinsamen Auftreten vom Nationalteam extrem wichtig. Er wollte Pünktlichkeit haben, er wollte klare Regeln, die Spieler umsetzen. Er war da schon relativ weit vom Coaching her. Er hat dort, weiß ich noch ganz genau, mit einem Pre-Game-Skate angefangen. Das heißt, am Spieltag haben wir in der Früh kein lockeres Warm-up gehabt oder vielleicht einen Spaziergang, sondern wir sind aufs Eis gegangen. Wir haben ganz normales Training gemacht. Das war zwar kurz, aber sehr intensiv. Nicht nur mit Schussübungen, sondern er ist sofort in Zweikämpfe gegangen. Er wollte, dass wir nicht nur körperlich, sondern mental auch bereit sind für intensive Partien am Abend. Es hat es damals im Jahr 97, 98 noch gar nicht gegeben in den Nationalteams. Das hat er eingeführt und bis zum heutigen Tage wird das natürlich gemacht. Er war dort schon sehr interessant in der Nominierung der Teams, der Spieler, weil er damals schon nicht die besten Spieler unbedingt genommen hat, sondern er wollte die richtigen Spieler haben. Der Charakter war ihm extrem wichtig, weil er gewusst hat, das ist ein langes Turnier. Es wird viele Ups und Downs geben und da kann er keine Spieler haben mit schlechtem Charakter, die vielleicht eine schlechte Stimmung eingebracht haben. Deswegen hat er bewusst auch manchmal sehr, sehr gute Spieler daheim lassen und hat Roleplayers, die für uns extrem wichtig war, weil sie Energie gebracht haben, weil sie in Unterzahl gut waren. Solche Spieler hat er mitgenommen. Viele Leute haben das wahrscheinlich zu Beginn kritisiert, aber der Erfolg hat ihm recht gegeben. Und das war schon damals ein sehr modernes Coaching. Und wie gesagt, er hat da extreme Energie reingebracht. Als Spieler war das ein richtiger Wake-up-Call. Es war der erste Schritt zum Profitum wirklich. Da habe ich persönlich auch sehr viel lernen können. Dafür bin ich auch sehr dankbar.
This is what I'd consider a loaded statement. So much in it from Marcus Pintner, who talked about his early days on the national team and immediately realizing, holy cow, this coaching is different. You had different values. You wanted different things. You established a morning skate. You wanted to all have them on time, the dress code that you were talking about. He also referred to the fact that you, when you had your national team roster put together, called up not necessarily the best players, but the right players. And he said, with you kind of being a trailblazer and way ahead of your time as a coach, at the very least compared to a lot of Austrian coaches, the energy that you brought to the table was unlike any other. Now, looking back on everything that happened, how fair of an assessment from Marcus Pintner is it compared to what indeed went down? You can just say, yes, this is totally fair, and this is how it went down.
Well, it's very nice compliments, and it's fair to say that stuff, but it was my energy and my passion for the game, But those are just things that I knew in my mind, that the skate, the boom, the body language. We talk to the kids to this day, and we talk to these players then, the importance of good manners. Like, a lot of young people think, you know, having not so good manners is pretty cool. No. Guys, good manners is a strength. You're on the streets with your buddies, you can do it. But, you know, have good manners, have respect for elderly people, and be presentable. So it's interesting that he says that, because I was still shooting from the hip trying to find my way. But I just knew energy and passion at a pregame skate and dressing good and having good manners, that's the start. And when you sit down to have dinner as a team, you don't wear hats. And, you know, you'd be respectable. That's just stuff I kind of think I had in me. But I was just sharing a little bit of my experiences with them. And like, Marcus was a young player playing for them. But don't forget, he earned it, because I didn't really know it. But you know what? I have a quick story for you. The U18, when we won the tournament, we beat, I think it was in Zagreb, and we upset Letland. We were down in the third period. That's when David Schuller had come back from Canada too, and he was flying and hitting and energy. And we had Melitzer and Pintner. We had a good group of guys. We came back and won that game in the third period. I think it was 4-3. The game-winning goal was Melitzer and Pintner involved. They both had casts on. These guys are freaking warriors. I took a picture of Melitzer and Pintner with their casts after the victory. So you think Marcus Pintner wasn't in my mind for the next freaking tournament, and Melitzer? These guys were warriors. I still have that picture to this day. But thank you. Nice compliments from Pintner, who is on his way now to becoming a very good coach with the youth program in Clanker.
And who's one of the all-time good guys in Austrian pro hockey. That just as another note. But let me get back to him referring to or saying you had not necessarily the best players, but the right players on your national teams. Is there kind of a prime example or one that immediately comes to mind where you try to get the right player and not the best player?
Well, not really. There's a few stories. Yeah, the Thomas Cook story, 16-year-old. Well, why would I take a 16-year-old when there's two or three 19-year-olds that should be on the team? Why would you take a 16-year-old? Stuff like that. Well, when he talks about character, you know, did I make all the right moves? Yeah, probably not always. And you're always going to have critics. It's just the way it is. So, for example, when I didn't take Thomas Cook because it was a present, and it's not because I didn't like those other guys. This freaking kid had something special. I could freaking see it. And we took him to Nagano, Japan, and you know the story. They kicked him off. He got 4 goals in that tournament, and, you know, my gut feeling on him was right. A couple other times, I think I mentioned in the past, like, good guy. It's not personal. But if you're two 19-year-olds are sitting down with the team, and I'm not there because I'm with Ron with the national team for 2 days, and two 19-year-olds get up, leave the hotel because the food's no good, and go to a restaurant downtown and have a pizza, you think they're going to buy into the team when we're ups and downs? So, you know, it's hard calls. You can't babysit a national team. And, you know, like I said, I'm shooting from the hip. We're rolling with this. And you try to make the right calls for the right reasons. I didn't always make the right calls. But I appreciate Marcus, who's a very good friend of mine to this day. I appreciate his nice comments. And we all think back to those times. You were with me when we talked to Thomas Cook and other players about And Velza, all these guys were a part of my coaching, all these good players. So what a pleasure for me to have so many good, young, talented guys. And look at some of the careers these guys had, from Setzinger to Velzer to Cook to Higers to so many, so many good players. I'm a lucky guy.
You indeed are. Also because of the fact that you kind of started growing as a coach even more than before, so alongside the late, great Ron Kennedy. And back in May, we had the distinct pleasure of looking back on a great hockey coach, probably the greatest coach Austria's ever seen. We did two podcasts due to his 70th birthday. Really had a great time and really enjoyed this conversation. So if you want to scroll down on the timeline here on Win Today Hockey O'Clock, just look up those two episodes and learn a lot about Ron Kennedy. We did an episode about Ron in English where you talked about him. We did another one in German with Herbert Hohenberger, longtime Austrian national team captain, Villach captain, dear friend of Ron's. But how was it for you, I'd say, or label it as a still aspiring coach, growing up in a coaching business next side to Ron Kennedy?
Well, you know the stories. I mean, I learned so much from Ron. And he treated the players fair. Practices were fast and tough. He was freaking organized with that yellow sheet, a yellow paper. He wrote everything down. So organized, did video. He was kind of ahead of his time. I mean, he was assistant coach in the NHL. He was coach of the year in the WHL, the top junior league. So when you look back, 5 years in a row, they were in the APO. In 1998, Nagano, 2002, Salt Lake City, two Olympics in a row. What a five-year span that Ron did with Joe Meehan. Dieter Kalt was involved, Dr. Bachler. We had a good group of guys.
Just for perspective for people listening to this, this would be unthinkable right now. We just had our national team remain in the APO for the second year in a row, for the second time in a row in the last, 23 years? The last time it happened was under Ron Kennedy. Now it's happened again the last couple of years. And in between, we went from the APO to the BPO, from the BPO to the APO. Just was up and down. So this continued excellence is so much out of the ordinary and so special. So I just wanted to provide some proper perspective to it.
Well, Martin, it was a pleasure to be part of it. And that was the best 5 years the Austrian Nats ever had for consistency, as you say. And Ron Kennedy led the freaking way. So 5 years in a row, earned to stay in the A-pole and in two freaking Olympics. So 1996-97, I'm coaching in Vatins in the second league. And in 1998, I'm at the freaking Olympics in Nagano. I mean, how fast did this happen? Did Ron saw something in me, which I'm sure he told Joe, that I went into the U18, U20, you know, a lot of apprenticeship to help out Ron with the national team. So I was putting my time in, learning as I went along, shooting from the hip. 1996-97, I'm coaching Vatins, and all of a sudden, I'm in Nagano at the 1998 Olympics. How freaking exciting is that story?
I got two more questions about Ron Kennedy, and you might have already answered them back in May when we did the pod due to his 70th birthday, but a lot of people might not have listened to that yet. So two more questions about him. What's the number one lesson, the number one thing that you learned from Ron Kennedy as a coach?
Well, there's three words, right? You practice tough, you're fair, and you're honest. And those are the exact things that I had, if you remember correctly, with Forbes Kennedy, who kind of saved my coaching, my playing career back in Winston-Salem. So he was organized. He was tough. he was fair, and he was honest. Now, you circle those four, and you played the game, you're going to be successful.
Would there have been a coach, Greg Holst, without a coach, Ron Kennedy?
Where I would have gone after the 96-97 season in Vatins, we went back to Canada in the summer. If I would have stayed there, would I have gone to Kimberley that direction again? I cannot answer that. I did have a couple interviews with the Kelowna Rockets as assistant coach, and I just about got that job. And that would have been after, that would have been probably after the 96. That could have been that summer. I did have a couple opportunities. I also, in the BCJHL, I was offered a, I think it was a 3-year contract to coach the Westside Warriors. But that's what I think. I was also involved with U18 to U20. So I did have job opportunities at home. And that Westside job was good paying. And you get a truck, which I love trucks. That almost got me. And in a really good league. And I'm living in Kelowna. I did have opportunities. I was very close to getting the assistant coach with the Rockets. And I did get offered a job with the Westside Warriors. And it would have been a 2 or 3 year contract. But I can't remember the exact time, but I did stay with U18. And as you know, it developed into something else as we went along.
That something else is something that we're going to talk about, especially during episode number 6 or part 6 of 70 in 7. But for the time being here on part 5, we have to divert a little bit from you climbing up the coaching ladders, because on the private side of things, there were also developments, not such fortunate ones as in terms of your professional career, because while you were making a name for yourself, you got separated and had to move on from that kind of phase of your life. And if you look out, and probably a lot of people can relate to this, not all relationships are made to last forever. There's sometimes just a natural end to things, and your relationship with your wife, the mother of you, of your two children, came to an end. How was that for you personally, and how did it affect everything that went on professionally?
Well, I've had dark times in my life, whether it was drinking or other stuff. I've been injured. I've had the crap beat out of me. I had that other stuff I talked to you about with my skin. I had a lot of tough times, but nothing comes close to when your marriage doesn't work out and you have two great children. This was really, really hard. If you ever heard of the word, which I had heard of, heartache, I remember it didn't work out in 2000, and I could see it coming. It's, I can't even say that word, what happened, because it's a word that I hate. But I'm going to say, when I drop the boys off and I go to the apartment that I got after, and they're looking at me like, there's my best buddies. Like, it was so freaking painful. And I know it was so hard for them. But I would drive back to my apartment and freaking tears. I get in the apartment. I had my chest. I had freaking pain. And that pain was heartache. I've broken up with girls before and stuff. Nothing compared to the pain I had in my chest, like this situation. And of course, it was from the breakup, but it was because of Mike and Taylor. It was freaking killing me. But just like in life, just like in sports, you lose, you get beat up. What do you have to do? You got to find a way to stand tall. I talked to my boys about it right away. Obviously, very tough conversation. But when I was with those kids, I was positive. I was upbeat. Then when I'd be on my own, I was having a hard time. But I had to find a way. And then I did go to these tournaments. So they kind of kept me going, U18, U20. And every chance I had, I stuck around for 2 years. I was with Mike Taylor as much as I could, took him to practice, picked him up at school. They come over. We played ball hockey, basketball, all the stuff Mike had mentioned every second I could. There was no schedule for when Christine would have them or when I would have them. It was open. I could get them when I wanted. There was no problem there. So that was all great. But I'm also going to tell you, I'm very thankful for the job Christine did when the kids were very young and how she worked with them with the schooling, how she cooked and how we traveled. So I have to really think now after the fact, I try to think of the good times that we had, and my kids are okay now. I know we were all upset at the time. I wish Christine all the best to this day. You know, I see her every now and then. It was the darkest, hardest time in my life. But what do you do with it? You got to stand up. You look it in the eye. You don't have a choice. So it's just like in hockey, when you're losing, you're going to get beat up. They're going to fire you. What do you do? You crawl under the table or do you stand up and you fight? So I had to find a way, but you asked me the question, the most difficult and darkest time in my life, but I survived it and my kids survived it. And we're doing good. We're doing real good.
Heartache is such an interesting, it's such a strong word, and begs the question, how many people at that time when the split kind of happened or was finalized did know about what was going on? How many people did you kind of let in on things? How many people were close to you emotionally at that time?
Nobody. People knew, I think, we were having a little bit of trouble. There was always, on my side, hope that somehow we could work this out. But I know the writing was on the wall. My parents did not know. My in-laws knew because I went up and told them right away. They had no idea. They were freaking shocked. But my parents, I didn't tell my parents, I think, for 4 months. But I told my boys right away. We sat down. We were all very upset. And I looked Mike and Taylor in the eye and those poor little great little guys. It was really, really hard. Let's be honest, guys. Let's get the cards on the table. We got to be positive. We got to stick together. Got to help mom. Got to do this. I was real positive. I know when I took off on my own, it was tough. You know, I walk out of there. You know, I was at the 75th anniversary of the New York Rangers with Sach and his oncology company in New York in 2000. And I came back. And then next thing you know, is, you know, a few days later, I'm in this situation and in the courtroom and I'm going, okay, A, B, C, D, they're looking at me and you have options. I said, Christine, what are you thinking? I walk out of there single. I didn't know what to freaking do. It was like freaking, not that it was a total shock. I knew it was coming. I think when the stamp is put on it, it becomes official, right? But, you know, it was no big, long, drawn-out thing. Everything was organized. The big thing was the biggest concern was my kids, obviously, right? But tough time. You find a way. But now, I was married 15 years. Now I'm walking out. I'm going, what do I do now? There was rumors, Martin. You know, people. I had girlfriends here, girlfriend there. You know, people talking about everything. And it just wasn't true. I know we're off the hockey part, but you asked me because I think it toughened me up even more because what happens in coaching can be pretty cruel. The people, the press, the stuff, the winning, the losing. And it's a different type of pain, but you got to stand up and fight for yourself, right? And we found a way, but we're all doing good now.
See, I'm really glad that you're opening on up on that side of things too, because I'm a firm believer in what kind of shapes you off the ice, shapes you to a certain degree in terms of all the on-ice stuff too. And so many difficult things are happening to so many different people. And my just be one of the life lessons people are taking away from this podcast and this series, especially that the life obviously goes on even after dark hours and dark times, as you labeled it. So I want to get to the bright side, or back to the bright side of things again, and something that I always wanted to talk to you about, and that I don't even know, because I think we never talked about it, but you were, as a coach, part of two Olympics. You coached at the 1998 Nagano Olympics, and you coached at the 2002 Salt Lake City Olympics for the Austrian national team. What's your favorite memory? And yep, there's only one possibility and one thing that you're allowed to mention right now, but what's your favorite memory of those two Olympic experiences?
Okay. Before I talk about that, can I just add something to the story we just talked about, which I think is important for anybody listening?
Is your series. You're allowed to add anything on everything that we talk about.
When I look back now at my marriage or my relationships with girls or after the fact, you look back and you go, there's so many things you could have maybe done a little bit differently, right? I know coaching and hockey too, but in your personal life. And when something doesn't work out, doesn't matter about the percentage, 50-50, 60-40. It takes two people to make something work, and it takes two people to make something not work. It's never 100% to zero. It might be 70-30, it might be 60-40, 50-50. If I could, communication, man, really being mature, it's not flight and run and hide. And it's looking problems in the eye, communicating, being mature. That's how we learn. I see it so different now years later because it's experience. So it takes two to make something work. It takes two to make something not work. And communication, boy, so valuable to anybody out there that's listening. Sit down, talk it out. Find a way. And now we go to the bright side of talking about the Olympics, right? Because I survived this. And now I've already been to one Olympics, and now I'm going to another one. I would say, don't forget, Martin, in 1984, I walked into the stadium with Ron Kennedy and the Austrian team in the Sarajevo Olympics. Walking in there, this is freaking amazing. Me and Ron then walked right up to the flame. That was in 84. But now we're kind of more in the modern times, getting to Japan, Nagano, Japan, Olympics. How freaking exciting is this?
Tell me all about it. How exciting is it being at the Olympics? And Sarajevo, if you look at those Olympics right now, and if you are in Sarajevo, most of the arenas and most of the places where events took place are kind of ruins right now, like literally. But how was it to be a coach at, I hate that term, but quote unquote proper Olympics in Japan, in the US?
Well, I'll tell you something is amazing. You walk, like I said, 96, 97, I'm in coaching Baton, secondly, doing the U18, or following up the U18 next year. And now, 1998, I'm at the Olympics. Walking into the village is so exciting. And me and Ron spent a lot of time together. Obviously, I was assistant coach, but we went to events. We went to have a beer. We did a whole bunch of stuff together. So what an experience. And you walk into the village, right? So now you go to have breakfast or lunch or supper in the village, in the big cafeteria. Well, there's Gretzky and the boys. I could go sit right over there where they are. There's the top skiers. Where's Hermann Meyer?
And Gretzky goes like, hey, this is Greg Holst, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's funny. You walk into the Olympics, right? And you walk in and they have fish and they have steaks. And who do you think is standing right there when you walk in? Big, tall man, Ronald McDonald. McDonald's right there, because all the athletes, when they're done, they like to have a burger and fries. But just seeing all the athletes and getting some autographs, I got a really funny autograph for Taylor. It was from Eric Lindros. He was great. He's a big dude, eh? And Eric Lindros was Taylor's favorite player. So I had a couple pictures of Eric, and I said, Eric, I'm with the Austrian team. I went, hi, how you doing, Greg? Would you mind signing this for my son, Taylor? You're his favorite player. It's his birthday coming up. Oh, no problem. So he signed one normal, and then he signed one. Happy birthday, Taylor. Ba-ba-ba. Yeah, best wishes, Eric Lindros. So I went back, and for Taylor's birthday, I gave him that. His freaking eyes lit up. And you know what he said to me? He said, Dad, where did you buy that? So it was so cute. And you know, Taylor was just a little fella, right? So a great story. And that was his favorite player. The guys were really so nice, though. I go to work out, too, with Ron. We go in the little gym. We work out. And who's standing over there beside me? Eiserman. He's talking to this guy. There's top players. There's Joe Sakic. He's going to have a workout. They're all good guys. That's something you just notice. Like, they're just great hockey players.
This is indeed great. And everybody who spent time at the Olympics, who was lucky enough to get there as player, coach, observer, spectator, broadcaster, it is truly a once-in-a-lifetime experience. So with the Olympics taking place in 2024, or this year in Paris, maybe a person or two listen to this will be lucky enough to get to the Olympics too. But as we kind of try to round out this conversation in part five of 70 in seven, what I was always wondering about is how it all came about that you coached for the national team in Austria exclusively and then turned out to be the Villach head coach. How did that all come about?
Okay, so it came to the point, it was 2002-2003 season. That was my first year. It came up, Selimse was in last place. They had called me if I was interested in coaching Selimse. Villach called me. I understand Ron put a bug in Joe's ear to give Greg a chance because this could work out. He's done a good job with the U18 to U20. Don't forget, U8 to U20. That's junior, right? And assistant coach with the national team is assistant coach. So they offered me, the contract was the same. It wasn't a huge contract. But both teams, you know, finances were tough. Villach and Sel back then. So I have to make a choice. I chose Villach. Nothing against Selimse. I said, okay, they had won the championship. I'm going to go into Villach. I played there. I had a really good year there. I know Joe. I know the national team guys. That's where I'm going. I played with Raffel and national team myself, and I played there. I got a little bit of connections, so I'm going to go. So I sat down with the contract, but what I did with the contract, you know me in contracts, because they had an evergreen ABO, so a season ticket, because they were having trouble, the money was trouble, so they gave these really good season tickets to forever. They were whatever, like the forever tickets, so they wanted fans because the attendance was down. So I sat down and talked to them, and I said, okay, look, the fix was okay, but it's not as high as a lot of other guys. So I still have to prove myself. I understand that. But if I remember exactly correctly, I said, how many fans did you have last year? Okay. If you have that many, but go everything you go above that, I just get a little piece of the action. And, you know, so not much, but stuff. And then we had playoff bonuses and making the playoffs, the semifinals, finals, stuff. So I just had little incentives all the way. Because I said, if we do well and you guys do well, you're going to make more money with the fans. So maybe I get a little piece of the action. So they said, okay. And off I went. But boy, was it a rocky start. And I know you're going to ask me about the rocky start.
First of all, I think it's interesting that your kind of contracts always came down to having a piece of the gate, having a piece of the spectator numbers. It's just interesting. But you brought in people, so I guess it's fair that you kind of requested that. But you know what? Let's talk about the rocky start. Why was it so rocky?
Okay, first of all, we brought Foster in. I think Foster came in that year from Selim, so he was a top scorer. But anyway, okay, we start off. These guys are champs. A little bit cocky, right? The team's cocky. They were champions. I don't think they accepted me, even though they knew I was a good player. I feel they looked at me and people looked at me as a junior coach, even though I coached in the second division and I coached assistant with the men national team. I feel they thought I was a junior coach. Oh, I never coached pro. He's a junior. But anyway, I knew a bunch of guys, and we practiced pretty hard. So we had a tough start. We were, I think, 2-7. A lot of close games. You lose in overtime. You lose a late one. It is irrelevant how you lose. The fans are freaking now on my ass. Freak, I'm not 9 games in, 10 games in. So what happens is, I mean, I couldn't go for a beer, Mark. That's how tough it was. And that's factual. They call me in. Management calls me in. Joe, Beyond, and Aesop. And they very well should, because they're under pressure. They just said to me, look, Greg, we're under pressure. Here's the situation. We got to do something. We're going to give you 3 games. And I said, how many do I have to win of those 3? They said, 3, or you're done. And that was in the paper. I got articles that that's factual. So we're going to bring Peter Raffel on board, not to be your Obachter. We're going to bring him on because I was doing, Secchi was my, did everything, the benches, cheering guys on, Kershaw was my backup goalie. But I ran the D, the forwards, the power play, the PK, change of lines. So we're going to be Peter Raffel on board, and he's going to help you out. I said, great. I know Peter. I play with him, national team. We're good. We went down to Steindorf the next practice. I remember this. It was snowing a little bit. And Foster, who we had moved because there was the circumstances. I hate getting rid of players. We had to make a move. There was a list of 10 things. I said, Fozzie, we got to make a move. He understood. He came injured. There was stuff. He's a good guy. Hate doing this. We brought in Sean Selmser. So we went down, had practice. Foster even came, said, Greg, is it okay if I practice with the team? I said, of course it is. We had a really tough practice. But if I remember correctly, I was on the ice where, but Peter had to talk to the players. And I don't want to put any words in his mouth, but I think this is how it went. He went in and told the players this. I'm just letting you go. So I'm here to help Greg. If he gets fired, I am not taking over this team. Just letting you guys know. Right? Because Ralph is the guy, and now they're all going, oh, Ralph, you're the guy, whatever. So we had Martin, one of the tougher practices I've ever had. We had a tough freaking practice. So we go back, and the 3 games, I'd love for you, you're the stat man, to find them. But if I remember correctly, was overtime, penalty shots, overtime, something like that. It was that fine a line. So now, ooh, we're starting to roll. We're practicing tough with my whatever. Like I told you, I'm not this great X and O guy, but we're going to practice pretty hard. I got good players. Keep them in freaking shape. That's the key, right? Ralph's helping. Oh, this is working good. Then we brought in Tom Surley. I think Tom Surley came back, and he was a tough defenseman. And he really solidified, gave us some bite. And like, he must have come back in around Christmas. I can't remember when. But anyway, I went to the U-20 at Christmas, came back. Raffel also learned at that point a little bit about being a kind of a head coach when I was gone. He didn't love it. I said, that's the way it is. You know how the guys are. I mean, it's egos. It's the way it is. It's okay. And as you know, we won the B pool down in Slovenia to go to the A pool in the U20. That was fantastic. So that kind of gave me a little boost too with the guys. But don't forget the players I have. Oh, Panic, Setzinger, Cork, Velzer. I mean, whoa, what a team we had.
Yeah, truly the last golden generation Austria
really
had.
Oh, my God. No, these guys, I just had to make sure I kept Setzi and Bad. I can keep all the guys happy with ice time because there was a, well, why is he on the 5-on-3? Why? You know, there's egos and there's guys want stuff. So I had my silk gloves out a few times. Great bunch of guys. What a team. Cork and these guys, Velzer. And we went to the airport. But I went back and Raf kind of had a good meeting with me. He said, oh, boy, these guys, now that you weren't here, it is a little bit different. But that's another story. And that's all good because that's the way it is, Martin. But then, as you know, we started winning. And we started winning. And we won a lot. And the fans came back, which was nice.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you rubbing your hands and knowing, oh boy, this is really good for my purse. But speaking of stories, we already heard from one of your very good friends in Markus Pintner. I want to use this opportunity to hear from another one because I, of course, asked Markus Kerschbaumer how those early weeks and months under Greg Holst were for players. He's a former goaltender. He's now probably the, not probably, he's the best goalie coach that Austria has seen. He's working for Red Bull Salzburg. And he's looking back on those first couple of weeks, months, you coached Villach. He was mostly a backup goaltender behind the four-time Austrian champion, Gerd Prochazka. I just want to listen in to Markus Kerschbaumer's observations when he looks back on that time, and then we're going to talk about it, and then we're going to round out this conversation.
Unser Start war vielleicht nicht der beste, wenn ich ganz ehrlich bin, weil als der Greg in der Saison 2002-2003 als Head Coach bestätigt worden ist, war seine erste Aussage, er will ein offensives, attraktives Eishockey spielen und ihm ist lieber, wenn wir das Spiel 7-6 gewinnen, als 2-1. Da haben natürlich beim Gerd Prochazka und bei mir sofort die Alarmglocken geläutet, weil wir gesagt haben, wir waren voriges Jahr die defensiv beste Mannschaft in der Liga. Wir haben wenig Chancen zugelassen und jetzt kommt jemand und will das komplett umdrehen. Mit dem waren wir gar nicht einverstanden. Des Weiteren waren dann seine ersten Trainings sehr fordernd, sehr offensiv orientiert. Wir haben sehr viele Schüsse gehabt. Wir haben uns zeitweise auf den Nachschuss nicht einmal vorbereiten können. Was wir aber Jahre zuvor immer so gemacht haben und gelernt haben von François Lerb, weil seine Camps haben wir ja immer besucht und er hat uns beigebracht, die wichtigste Arbeit ist nicht beim Schuss, sondern die passiert vor dem Schuss. Und das haben wir natürlich nicht machen können. Und da waren wir sehr, sehr, sehr verwirrt am Anfang und nicht unbedingt immer glücklich mit dem Krieg. Eines Tages hat der Krieg dann beschlossen, dass wir am Ende des Trainings einen Backskate machen. Die ganze Mannschaft ist in die Ecken gefahren und der Gerd und ich sind mal im Torraum geblieben, weil wir auch von François Allaire gelehrt bekommen haben, dass wir in unseren Torraum flüssig und dynamisch bewegen müssen und voll mal kontrolliert. Und wir beginnen dann mit unseren Kriegsmoments und plötzlich schießt der Greg her und hat gefragt, was wir da tun. Also ein Eislaufen. Nein, das ist kein Eislaufen. Wir müssen runter zur Mannschaft, dann müssen wir alle gemeinsam mit der Mannschaft Eislaufen und mit dem waren wir überhaupt nicht einverstanden, weil auf der einen Seite sagt uns der François Allaire, wir müssen den Turm Eislaufen und dann müssen wir unsere Bewegungen kontrollieren. Auf der anderen Seite kommt dann der Headcoach daher, der das offensive Spiel forciert und sagt, wir müssen da mit Eislaufen. Und ich weiß, die Story sieht der Greg ein bisschen anders, weil er sagt immer, wir wollten nicht Eislaufen, das stimmt so nicht ganz, sondern wir wollten schon Eislaufen, aber eigentlich unsere Dormann-spezifischen Sachen.
This is great. Because it covers so many different aspects, and Marcus Cashbaumer took us back to around the time where you became a head coach and how different practices were, and that you apparently said right around becoming a head coach that you'd rather win a game 7-6 than be in a low scoring affair. And all the alarms went off with the goaltenders and the team that had the best defense the year prior. And then he talked a little bit about practice and how you made them participate in all the drills and really skate hard and work hard, whereas they had learned from the great François Allaire, whose goalie camps they had visited, how to properly have a goalie practice. How much, and he said you might differ on some things that he just mentioned. How much of that, what Marcus Cashbaumer said, was accurate? How much would you like to differ?
Well, I had forgotten about that offensive part, because that is very true. But you know what happened today? And I'm pretty honest. Let me have it from Cashbaumer. I talked to him today. And I said, Marcus, you know what? You were the top five goalie coach in Austria. He took a second and he kind of laughed. So, Mark, I think I got to stick with that after that. Freaking no, he is the best. He's the best goalie coach that Austria has ever had. Fantastic. Hey, and he put the truth down how he saw this. And now that he mentions that, I remember saying that. Hey, the fans, they'd love 7-6, not 2-1. So right away, my ideas was the wrong way of thinking. Right? Even though U18, U20 was wrong, we're defensive and all that. But I said, hey, let's just go after this and score. We need fans. We have no fans. The fans are way down. Offense will probably get the again. I don't know if I thought like that. But the skating part is true, because you know why? When I, in the NHL, I watched Hasek and I watched Patrick Waugh, and I have videos of it. They used to love skating with the guys at the end when they did the lines, because they wanted to be first. How goalies? Of course, you have to do your goalie stuff. Mentioning that, I believed in that the goalies, I still do it with the kids. I don't know if they all love it, but the kids, the goalies like it because they get used to it, but they still do all their stuff. I understand his point. We did headbutt. I headbutt with Praska, as you know, because I believed him. But I thought it was important for maybe not the whole skate, but a part of that skate. It's not a bag skate. It's like 8 or 10 minutes of skating. The goalie's up and down. I think it's part of the team. And I remember watching Hasek. He hated when he lost. But he's right. I was thinking too offensive. Did I change my way of thinking after those three games? You're freaking right I did. And you know my thoughts on now how I am. Scoring three goals, getting two against. So you see how my whole mindset, but what he said is very accurate.
I want to round this indeed out with not a real spoiler alert. The first season you coached an adult pro hockey team in 2002-03 eventually came to an end with a finals loss. You had a rocky start to the year. You eventually came to grips with the job and what it took to be successful. You string together wins. You got into the playoffs. You won two series and the quarters and the semis. You even won the first game in the finals. Back then, best of five, lost the next three to an up-and-coming Linz team. And we're going to talk about that rivalry for a little bit on the next episode of 17-7. But how do you look back as a whole on that first year as a head coach in the Austrian League and on that finals loss?
Well, a total learning experience, right? But winning the U20 to go to the eight pole, that was a highlight. Surviving, almost getting fired, not being able to go for 2 months for a freaking beer, And you know what, Martin? After that practice in Steindorf, remember when we had our first practice when they gave me the three games? We came out after practice. We're driving back to Fielek from Steindorf. It's snowing a little bit. And I'm driving with Raffel. And the windshield wipers, he goes, Greg, what's on your window? I said, I don't know. It's a big square thing, a pretty good size. I pull over the car. I bring it in. It's plastic laminated. I have this. And on this plastic laminated, one side is Ryan Foster. Top scorer, great guy, babe. Other side, Holtz, coach, 2-7. He's a flop. He's a bum. Cole, these were on all the cars. So then you go back and squeak three games out. And they weren't high scoring games, just letting you know, as I remember. And now all of a sudden you find your way. You make the playoffs. You win the first. I think the second round was best of five. If I remember correctly, Kurt Harron was coach of Vienna. We won game five. Nothing with the late goal from Sean Selmser, the guy that we brought in when we made the move. And then we went to the finals. Yeah, we lost in six. I think we lost in six. Yeah, we lost at home in game six. Really close to the end. We kind of had a bad change, a turnover, something jumped in. That's why this change, you tell the kids nowadays, the importance of coming off hard. Something did happen there, not on purpose, but player was coming off. It was a tight game. I think it was tied. Player's coming off outside. I want to say a name, but he's coming off slowly. So our next player couldn't jump on. There was a quick turnover in the neutral zone. They attacked. Herbie didn't have time to get set because it happened so fast. Because we couldn't get that extra player on. And I think Eunice walked in, made a move, scored, and that became the winning goal. But what an experience. Okay. Do I have a contract for the next year? No. I always did one-year contracts. I had a one-year contract. So now we make the finals. And now lots of fans. And now I have to, am I coming back or not? Let's try it all again.
And you know what? We'll be getting to that stage of your career, to that phase after the year. As it stands, in 03, there was a finals loss against Linz. There would eventually be some kind of redemption, but there would also be a lot of heartbreak. And this time around, this is going to be our cliffhanger. I do know that we didn't necessarily hit the year 2004 yet, the year where you turned 50, but there's no better way to round this conversation out but just saying thank you for taking, again, almost 2 hours out of your valued time talking about the fifth decade of your being. We've got two more episodes to go. I'm so much looking forward to it. Thank you so much for doing this, coach. Already looking forward to hearing you next week right here on Win Today Hockey O'Clock.
Martin, my pleasure, and I can't wait to beat Karis Bomber on the golf course. And we will talk next week. The next one is pretty exciting too. And if I may add, just before we walk out of here, he said, what did you really learn? And you learn every year, defense wins. It's not offense.
Win today, Hockey O'Clock.
Kurz durchatmen bei diesem Wahnsinn. Und das ging rasend schnell. Der Traum vom Finale ist erfüllt. Mittendrin statt nur dabei. Fans, stimmungsvoll und hoffnungsfroh. Nice move, another nice move. Oh, he scored!